You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the federal government will soon allow people to download plans for guns that can be made at home on a 3D printer. We'll talk to a gun violence expert about how prepared our current laws are for the change and whether he expects an impact on gun violence. First, the 2016 presidential campaign and election saw deepening divides between people who held very different political and worldviews. Those divisions were even within political parties at times, not to mention cutting through communities and even families. A group of researchers at UW-Madison decided to look at how information gathered from mass media, social media, and other sources shape and strengthen those ideas and those divisions. They're looking specifically at Wisconsin. Lou Friedland is Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at the UW-Madison and the principal investigator on the project. Lou, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Now, this is ongoing research. You have this new grant now from this special university program. But talk about, you kind of have a super group of academics, a lot of familiar names on this show and on the Ideas Network. Talk about your group and what you've been doing.
Well, our group's been working since about late 2011, 2012, when it became clear, I think, to most residents of Wisconsin that there was something unique, something special happening in this state. We became what has been now called one of the most contentious, divided states politically in the United States. And we felt that that was something very, very important to understand. Most of us are political communication scholars. So the foundation of our work is Kathy Kramer's work, who wrote The Politics of Resentment. I'm sure many of your listeners will know her. Devon Shaw, who's a leading international specialist on social media and many other things. Mike Wagner, who studies politics in Wisconsin. Chris Wells, who studies Twitter and social media. And we've been joined by Carl Rowe in statistics and William Satharis in computer and electrical engineering for the big data aspect. So it's kind of a large group of principals, yeah.
And you're trying to track how our media use, and this is print media, TV, radio, social media, all the stuff, plays into these divisions, this divided Wisconsin.
That's exactly right. We're trying to understand what role what we call the communication ecology as a whole has in either creating these kinds of divisions, exacerbating these kinds of divisions, in some cases possibly mitigating these divisions. But we do think that the changing communication ecology in our state has had some role in the direction that the state's been going politically in the past roughly 8 years.
Now, there's this notion that, in part because of the internet and different cable news sources, that, we are kind of going into our own little bubbles or echo chambers or filter bubbles. People call them different things. There's almost like a conventional wisdom. How do you start to try to pin that down and say, is it happening and what's it doing to us?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's hard, as you might imagine. We're trying to approach this from two different perspectives. One is to construct, what we call the macro ecology. And that's, for example, the decline of newspapers in the state, the decline of statehouse reporting in the state. So you might think of that as the supply side of news. Are people getting the supply of news that they want and need about the state? And where is that coming from and how does that affect people? And then Kathy and I in particular and graduate students working with us are going out and re-interviewing people from her original study to try to get a what we call a micro or a person eye view of how people actually make sense of this media environment in terms of their own political and civic commitments.
So talk more about the data you all are going to be trying to crunch. It's you're listening to talk radio shows from a long period. You're looking at who connects with what and whom on Twitter. There's a lot out there.
Yeah, there are many, many layers to this project, and I certainly won't try to name them all, but we're looking at, we're assembling all the newspaper articles about Wisconsin politics for the past 10 years. We have 42 waves of Charles Franklin's Wisconsin poll that he's generously allowed us to use. So that's a kind of floor, if you want to think about it that way. How have Wisconsinites reacted to various issues over the past roughly 10 years? We have 10% of all Twitter in the world. that were then sort, you know, that from which we're factoring out Wisconsin politics and looking at the networks and who's tweeting what to whom over around what kinds of issues with what kind of tone and valence. How do conservatives and broadly progressives differ from each other on Twitter, and if so, how? And then, of course, we're also looking at political statements. We're trying to parse out campaign and candidate statements over this same period to try to understand how that input from politics actually then enters into and flows through the communication ecology.
Talking to Lou Friedland from the UW-Madison Schools of Journalism and Mass Communication, looking at this big ongoing project, looking at Wisconsin's media landscape and how it affects the way we think about politics and partisan division. Lou, let's start digging into that now. To what extent are we in Wisconsin living in different worlds?
Well, I think that's one of the questions we really want to answer. And clearly, I mean, Kathy's work showed as clearly as anything has that we do live in different worlds to some extent, that rural Wisconsinites, small city Wisconsinites, not living in the large cities of Madison or Milwaukee metro, do see the world differently, that they do have resentments about certain kinds of distribution of state resources and whether they're being listened to or not politically. And that's one important starting point. But of course, people in Milwaukee feel that way too, right? There are plenty of folks in Milwaukee of different races and ethnicities, and not only, who feel like they haven't been listened to or they don't have adequate say in their political lives. And of course, Madison is its own little universe, as those of us who live here know. So there are many, many corners of the state, and we do live in our own world. Now, the question is, how isolated are those worlds from each other? And the echo chamber filter bubble metaphor tends to imply that we are all living in these little worlds. But our research shows that there's more crossover in these worlds than some of the filter bubble advocates would say. But how much is still an open question.
And how do we know, or do we know, if going into a filter bubble, to the extent that we do, maybe restricting ourselves to one kind of diet of media, does that really then affect the way we think, the way we behave politically?
Well, we know that if people are living in a filter bubble, if people are primarily exposed to one form of media, one political perspective, whether it's because they consume, say, conservative talk radio, a diet of conservative talk radio and Fox News, and some people do primarily, or because they live in their own little Facebook worlds of like and like-minded friends and family, we can be relatively isolated in pockets of people like ourselves. So it does happen, and there is a kind of what we call homophily effect going on there. But the question is, are there bridges between those worlds? Are there still cross-cutting conversations going on? And if so, what difference do they make?
You know, I think maybe it wouldn't necessarily be helpful if we find that, say, a liberal and a conservative are clicking on the same thing. Because I say, you know, at work, I'm on Twitter a lot, and there are often these inflammatory pieces that if you agree with them, you click on them to read and enjoy. And if you are angered, people call it hate clicking. You look at it to see how ridiculous the other side is. Both sides looked at it. It didn't really build a bridge.
No, that's a really important point. I mean, one of the things that we're trying to sort out is how much cross-cutting conversation is exactly, or cross-cutting communication, I should say, is exactly of that type. Like, well, I'm a liberal looking at a conservative piece from Breitbart, but mostly to forward onto my friends and say how ridiculous it is, or vice versa. And clearly a significant amount of cross-cutting communication is of that sort. But we also know that people are exposed, for example, in their Facebook feeds to some sort of cross-cutting information just from families. And it may be, you know, your uncle who's sending you stuff, and you may half the time say, oh, I can't believe how liberal or how conservative he is, or he can't believe that stuff, but you're still getting exposed to it. And we have some evidence that when people are exposed to cross-cutting information, that it does possibly make some difference in tempering their views.
We're talking with Lou Friedland of the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He's involved in a project looking at how the information we get from traditional and social media can deepen maybe the political divides that we see and finding out if there are ways to bridge those gaps, focusing on Wisconsin in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you try to get news from a variety of sources from across the political spectrum? Do you converse with people with different points of view than your own? Are you able to talk about politics with people you disagree with, or do you agree to disagree and shut up about it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Lou Friedland of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the UW-Madison, telling us about a project that's looking at the information ecologies, ecosystems that we live in, and how it impacts our beliefs, how we relate to other people who might hold different ideas than our own. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you access information? How do you assess information you get from the media, whether that's a newspaper, broadcast, or social? If it comes from a source you agree with politically, do you still sometimes look at it critically and second guess it? What about news you get from friends or family who agree or disagree with you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I want to talk about our communication ecology here in Wisconsin a little bit, Lou. And one thing that people have pointed out that's kind of unique in Wisconsin is conservative talk radio not just airing national programs, but with really strong Wisconsin-based ones. We had a guest on the Ideas Network who was very much in favor of conservative talk radio and who did a documentary on it saying this is unique and special in Wisconsin in ways that we might not realize.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's, you know, the role of Charlie Sykes in the past 8 years, 10 years can't be overestimated. You had Charlie on for about three and a half hours a day, I think it was, for most of that period through last year on the most powerful AM radio station in the state. And he is closely connected to the Republican Party. And so you actually have a central broadcasting point, literally, for the views and ideology, if you will, of one party and one side. And you have no actual counterpoint. And I think that has made a big difference in filling a gap in Wisconsin. I mean, another parallel fact is that the role of newspapers has declined. So the State Journal, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which was a relatively powerful center liberal voice in the state for a long time, went from about 290,000 statewide circulation in 2000 to only 190 in 2010. So lost a third of its readership. So as they were going down, talk radio was rising. And at the same time, you had that unique role of Charlie Sykes, but you also have 70 hours of conservative talk radio daily being broadcast in the 13 major markets of this state. So it's a pretty well saturated conservative talk radio environment.
Is that something that sets an agenda in a way that, say, the left in Wisconsin might not have, something that's cohesive?
Well, it certainly does set an agenda. There's no question about that. You see that when you look at, for example, the two Twitter sides, that Sykes was really important not only for on the radio and, of course, extraordinarily influential, but also the Twitter sphere partly reflects what Charlie said, what Charlie retweeted. And, of course, Charlie himself was in conversation with Governor Walker on a regular basis. So you got a fairly straightforward conduit from the governor and that point of view straight to the populace in a fairly only semi-filtered way.
I should say Charlie Sykes will be on this network tomorrow morning at 8 on our morning show. And I think he's part of the story in another way. He's no longer doing that show. He was in some ways a Republican who fell out with the Trump wing of his party, and now he's still a never Trumper.
Right. No, he is, and I think he's said that his role in part over this period of time might have played some role in the rise of Trump, because at some point when you've criticized the university, the role of science and so on over time, that it starts to erode people's trust in government and the environment more generally.
Talking to Lou Friedland from the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He and colleagues are part of a big effort to analyze Wisconsin's media landscape and how it plays into partisan politics and partisan divisions here in the state. And Lou, we've seen the rise of fact-checking lately here in Wisconsin and around the country, and this concern that people from different political backgrounds have their own sets of facts, in a way. How do we get here?
Well, that's a good and a tough question. I just read a piece this morning by a professor at North Carolina named Daniel Kreese, who basically argues that we now have our own epistemologies. Essentially, we have our own different ways of seeing the world, and because of our strong social identities that are now divided by party, that we actually see the world through these lenses, so that the center ground of facts actually doesn't exist anymore. I'm not sure that that's true, but it certainly is a direction that we're headed in.
We've had partisan media in this country since before we were a country. There have been vitriolic disputes taken through early newspapers and pamphlets and beyond. Is this just more of the same, or is something different now?
I think something's fundamentally different. We've had cycles, as you say. We've had strongly partisan media in the 19th century, but now we have essentially an ecosystem in which one thing feeds another, so that Matt Drudge can post something. It then goes out on Twitter. The president sees it. It gets fed back into the conservative media ecosystem. Fox News rebroadcasts it. The president goes on Fox to talk about it. So you have a series of feedback loops, especially in the conservative media universe, that you haven't had before. But of course, you also have that, if you will, on the broadly left or progressive side of the spectrum, in the social media ecosphere as well. So we have two sets of interacting kind of ecologies that make this much different than it ever has been.
Let's bring on a caller now. Virginia is with us in Janesville. Virginia, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to tell us about?
Well, my husband and I both stay off of social media intentionally. We don't want to get caught up in the fray. I don't think, besides news network that we have to watch every day, we could handle any more comments and misleading information, so we just stay off of it. I did say that we had guests this weekend, and I never understood supporters of Trump that continue to stand by him no matter what he does until this weekend when we were talking to conservative friends. And they led us to believe that there were other issues, perhaps, that they maybe didn't agree with him on. But by the end of the weekend and their visit, they said to us, "You are very opinionated, aren't you?" And they said their only issue, they had one issue that caused them to vote the way they voted, and that they were not willing to talk about or compromise on anything else. And for the first time, I had a better understanding of what we're up against in this country, not only individuals, but the politicians who just refuse to compromise.
Virginia, thanks a lot for the call. Lou, a lot there. Virginia feels like she better understood a conservative acquaintance and now knows better what she's up against. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's, first of all, Virginia, it's great that you had that conversation. It sounds like an example of a hard but a good conversation that it would be good if we all had more of. And I also, even though I'm a professor of journalism, I also feel the same way you do on some mornings where I don't want to, I do want to turn on the radio, but I don't want to necessarily log on to social media. I do think that we have hardened our positions, and there are folks on both sides. You've just very eloquently recounted where we have our bedrock positions and we can tell each other what they are, but we're not likely to persuade each other very much.
Virginia, thanks for the call. Go next to Terry in Green Bay. Terry, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I used to be a local radio news reporter, and I worked at conservative talk radio stations, and the local news was always, you know, objective and stuff like that, but when the right-wing conservative talk radio was blaring in the background, that was the entertainment side of things. And one thing I've come to learn is it is the most vile stuff when it comes to free speech and media that is out there today. I'm calling for some sort of implementation of the fairness doctrine or something like that. Bring that back into play.
Terry, thanks a lot for the call. So, news guy at the conservative talk station, not wild about what played after his news break was done.
Well, Terry's absolutely right. It was the decline of the fairness doctrine and a series of changes made in the 1980s that basically gave rise to the AM stations and the rise of conservative talk radio across the country that no longer had to all broadcast stations no longer had to give both sides. Now, conservatives fought tooth and nail against the reintroduction of the fairness doctrine for exactly that reason. But it's not a bad idea to start thinking about how we might get some more balance across the broadcast media.
Terry, thanks a lot for the call. Lou, a lot of places we could go to end the conversation for now. I'll ask this. Is there an equivalent to conservative talk radio? Is there something on the left that fills that role with the sort of power and cohesion that it has?
The short answer is no, that there's nothing with the power and cohesion. Conservative talk radio and conservative media in general have much stronger, much more coherent messaging over time. The left, if you will, has social media, which, as we all know, it can be as many things, as many groups as people as use it. So there isn't really a counterpart.
And we heard on Facebook from Eric, who says, I listened to NPR, WPR, CBN, BBC, Rush Limbaugh, and Mark Belling. The first four listed are left-leaning. The last two are from the right. I think a lot of people on the conservative side in our last few minutes view like a CNN or NPR as the left balance to the right.
Sure. I've observed that for a long time. I know we're talking about objective facts are hard to establish, but most studies have shown that, yeah, there might be some slightly center liberal skew occasionally, but really there's nothing like Fox News on the left side of the spectrum, other than MSNBC, but that's a much smaller, less influential news outlet.
Lou, we'll leave it there for now. I think we'll probably check in as this study goes on. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Lou Friedland is Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Joins to talk about this ongoing project looking at how and where people in Wisconsin get their news and information and how that fits into political divides. Now the federal government will allow people to download blueprints for guns that they can make on a 3D printer starting August 1st. This comes after the State Department settled a legal dispute with gun rights advocate Cody Wilson of Texas. In 2013, Wilson posted plans for a single-shot plastic pistol on his website. The government then told him to take down the plans, and Wilson responded with a lawsuit in 2015. His company, Defense Distributed, celebrated the recent settlement, saying, quote, "The age of the downloadable gun formally begins." Daniel Webster is the director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research and a professor of health policy and management. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Well, I'm not the state of 3D printers that are still kind of expensive. I don't know what the quality of guns will be. But that said, when you heard about the settlement that the government made here, making it legal to distribute these plans for print-at-home guns, what did that make you think about? What does that mean for our future here?
Well, it gives me great concern, honestly. Look, I understand that the direction of technology and that currently it's possible to make these types of guns. But I think California is the one jurisdiction where they're starting to see more of these so-called ghost guns, untraceable guns that are manufactured in this way. But it hasn't hit most of the rest of the country. And, to me, this is just making it very easy for people to have really no accountability and kind of completely undermine common sense laws that, you know, were decided upon to try to keep us safe, try to keep guns out of the wrong hands.
The idea of a homemade gun would mean that any background checks wouldn't happen, no serial numbers on these guns. What would this mean from a law enforcement perspective?
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. The way guns are manufactured and sold in the United States for very long time. We require serial numbers. We require record-keeping processes, background checks. Our gun laws are nowhere near what they really need to be to be fully effective in keeping guns out of the wrong hands. But the basic structure is there for accountability and to screen out individuals who our laws say are too dangerous to have them. So much of the ability to connect the dots, so to speak, between where a gun came from and when it's recovered from, say, a felon or some other prohibited person, it's all based upon the serial numbers and the laws that require anybody who's making or selling these guns to have proper records. So it's very concerning if guns would just go into circulation with no means of accountability of who ultimately put that gun into somebody's hands that might be used to commit any number of violent crimes.
Now, if I am someone who is, for whatever reason, not allowed to buy a gun, I'm already banned from buying a gun, it would still be illegal for me to possess this home-printed gun, right? The background check wouldn't prevent me buying it from someone because it wouldn't be there, but it would still be illegal as it already is.
That's correct. In my opinion, there should be increased penalties for possessing a gun that hasn't been, properly regulated through manufacturing and sale. Yes, someone prohibited from possessing a gun does face penalties as it is, but I would argue that the laws are there not only to, in essence, penalize someone who's prohibited from having a gun. They're also there as a check on anybody who might put a gun in the prohibited person's hands. And what widespread 3D manufacturing of guns would create is total undermining of that accountability. So the end result would be a lot more dangerous people have lethal weapons.
Talking to Daniel Webster from the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research, professor of health policy and management there, looking at this new settlement from the U.S. government allowing the distribution and sale of blueprints for firearms to be printed on these 3D printers, these at-home manufactories that people could then use to print their own firearms without background checks or serial numbers. Want to give a listen to Annalise Dickman of the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort, a gun control advocacy group, talking about the impact she thinks the case is going to have.
In terms of numbers of guns, it's probably not a big impact. What's more concerning is that the administration, in settling the suit, has made it clear that they don't feel it's necessary for everybody who owns a firearm to have passed the background check.
Let's break down both parts of that, Daniel. We already have a fair amount of guns in the United States. Do you see this ability to print at home or a workshop making a big difference in the number of guns out there in the country?
I doubt that it will have an enormous impact on the overall number of guns available. I think the impact also will vary a great deal depending on the state. Our states vary tremendously in the degree and the manner in which we regulate firearms. And so in states with more heavy regulations, such as California or New Jersey or Massachusetts, for example, I suspect that these will become a more important means by which prohibited people access guns. In states like Wisconsin that generally have more lax laws, there may be little need or motivation to make your own gun or to, in essence, get in the business of selling those types of guns, because there are other avenues for people to profit by selling guns to prohibited people, and without the background checks and other requirements that make it challenging, I'm not saying impossible, but making very challenging to hold somebody accountable if they're selling guns to prohibited people.
And the other,
I think the impact, again, will vary depending on the state.
And the other part of that quote pointed toward kind of sending the message that it's not that important for people to have firearms to get background checks when they obtain guns. Is that something that concerns you?
Oh, yes, a great deal. Look, background checks are not the magic be-all and end-all, but they're pretty fundamental to any kind of system that you want to put in place to keep guns out of the wrong hands. And it's clear individuals with histories of violence really should not have lethal firearms available, and it's not a particularly controversial matter.
Talking with Daniel Webster right now, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research, looking at the government settling a case that will make it legal now to download the plans for guns that can be made on these 3D printers that are becoming more common out there. This will go into effect August 1st. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it should be legal to distribute plans online for 3D printed guns? And to then create guns at home or at a workshop, distribute them? Would you ever do this yourself, print and assemble a firearm? If you are a gun owner yourself, what do you think of this idea of people making their guns on 3D printers at home? Still expensive, but not prohibitively so for some. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Daniel Webster, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research, looking at a settlement from the federal government that makes it legal to download plans for 3D printable guns that will be legal as of August 1st. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? Blueprints online people can download and make on 3D printers. Some people have them around. There are some at various workspaces around the country, getting cheaper and more common as time goes on. If you're a gun owner, what do you think of this idea? Is this something you'd want to do, whether you own a gun or not? Do you worry about the availability of more firearms without background checks? And what do you think this means for gun laws and gun control in the country? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. To your calls now, Alex is with us in Green Bay. Alex, hi. We lost Alex there in kind of a weird way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Looks like Daniel, Alex's point was that it is legal for hobbyists to get pieces for guns, assemble them on their own at home. And he says if you have the means to do 3D printing, you probably already had the means to make your own guns. Is this anything all that different, he wonders?
Well, I will admit that it is possible without a 3D printer to make your own guns. What I believe is the case is that a 3D printer makes it a heck of a lot easier. So there's various debates and discussions about, different scenarios in which individuals could make or acquire guns. And just because something is possible doesn't mean it's likely to happen a lot. So what I fear is that the availability of 3D printing of guns widely available will make it far easier, and therefore a lot more people will do it. So that's my principal concern.
Let's go to another caller now. Ted is with us in Whitewater. Ted, hello.
Hello.
What do you think?
I actually am kind of disgusted in that ruling on the law. I have always been an avid gun owner, and I've always tried to obey the laws. I always try to do it right properly. I make my applications when I buy a gun. I register my guns, and I look at this as just a way for criminals, I'm sorry to say, to get around the law and get a gun that they shouldn't have. The whole reason why there is a law for guns.
Ted, thanks a lot for the call. So a gun owner there, Daniel, who sounds like he doesn't mind his background checks, worried about this as a loophole.
Yeah, I'm not surprised at all with that because, look, if you're a law-abiding person, it's really not hard for you to buy a gun. You don't have to be able to make a gun yourself in order to exercise your Second Amendment right. What the availability, wide availability of 3D printing of guns would create is, again, sort of an undermining of a set of laws that actually there's far more agreement upon than what people realize. We generally think of any and all discussions of gun policies as being highly, that there's a lot of disagreement. But the basic ideas of certain individuals are too dangerous to have them, and you should have some process to screen out those individuals is really not controversial at all. And I'm not surprised at the last caller's views.
Thanks for the call, Ted. We'll go next to Kelly in Cascade. Kelly, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm definitely having a strong negative emotional reaction to this whole thing, and just feel like as a country we keep setting ourselves up to put guns and weapons, high-powered weapons, into the hands of the wrong people. And as a law-abiding citizen, I want my background checked if I'm going to take that move. I want to know that whoever is thinking of putting a gun in my hands deems me safe to do so. I work as a therapist, and I do assessments on patients to make sure they're cognitively safe to get out in a car and drive on the road to live at home by themselves. And this is just putting giving people the means to, do a whole lot of damage.
Kelly, thanks a lot for the call. So, Kelly, angry about the idea of people having, unregulated 3D printing guns. Daniel.
Yes. I'm not surprised. I think whether you're a gun owner or you're not, I think generally speaking, I think most people are going to be very concerned about this. There's other far more complicated questions to consider with respect to rights to simply publish information. You boil down the legality of what's being concerned now of making the information available of how to make the blueprints, in essence, for these guns. So that's sort of an interesting legal question. But when you break it down to what the actual implications are, again, I suspect that most people are going to have similar concerns wherever you are and whether you own guns or don't own guns. It represents a clear threat. Maybe not immediately, and maybe not in all places, but I believe that it will affect public safety in a detrimental way.
Kelly, thanks for that call. We're talking about the idea of 3D printing guns. Daniel Webster with us from the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research. It will be once again legal legal in, starting on August 1st for people to post the blueprints for plans to print guns. Still expensive technology, but maybe becoming less so over time. Paul joins us now in Milwaukee. Paul, hi.
Hey, how's it going? I just had a quick comment where, from what I've seen and researched in the level of the 3D market available to average consumers, we're not at a level yet where you can print your own gun at home. The only materials are plastics. We can't really print metal alloys yet. So I don't think this will affect us for another 4, maybe 5 years. But truly, I think what is going to help us with gun safety is just having these discussions and developing the culture of America to be more gun aware. So I think this is going in the right direction, and not necessarily something we have to worry about for another 4 or 5 years as the market develops.
Paul, thanks for the call. Daniel, what do you think of Paul's idea of having these discussions and a changing culture around guns?
I agree with it 100%. Again, as I said before, there are things that people disagree about guns and if and how to regulate them. But there's a lot more that we agree upon, and there's a shared hope that we can possess guns safely and do our best to keep guns out of the wrong hands. So, again, I don't think these are controversial kinds of things. I also agree that it's not the immediate sense that I see the public safety threat, but on their horizon, I do.
Paul, thanks a lot for that call. Daniel, as we start to wind down, you look at gun violence in large part as a public health issue. This 3D printed gun issue is a part of the puzzle, but not the whole story, of course. What kind of interventions do you see really making a difference in our last minute when it comes to lowering the impact of gun violence?
Well, the type of gun policies, anyway, we find to be effective in reducing gun-related mortality are, again, sort of comes down to basic common sense. The broader the restrictions are on people who actually have a history of violence, the bigger the impact of reducing gun violence. We find that licensing or permitting systems for handgun purchasers also are effective in reducing homicides as well as suicides. So on the policy front, those are key measures that I think are that there's evidence behind. Now, there are also community interventions to try to focus on those at the highest risk and help to mediate conflicts between high-risk groups and individuals, as well as policing strategies that are focused. Again, our urban gun violence problems and solutions have to be very, very focused on those at highest risk. And we do have the interventions that combine focused law enforcement with outreach and in essence assistance to get them on the right path has a pretty good track record in lowering gun violence.
We'll leave it there for now. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Daniel Webster is the director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research and a professor of health policy and management. We've been talking about guns, in particular, the idea of 3D printing guns, blueprints, legal online starting in August.